can get into the idea of, well, maybe there is something going on really with this GLP-1 deficiency concept, and we'll talk about why. I mean, I just read a paper yesterday that the GLP-1 deficiency is really common in people with fatty liver disease. Now, fatty liver disease is a consequence of our high sugar starch diet and ultra-processed food. It affects probably 90 million Americans, which is a precursor to heart disease and cancer and diabetes and a whole bunch of other stuff. Even kids as young as 15 are needing liver transplants from fatty liver disease. So we know that at least in fatty liver disease, there is a GLP-1 deficiency. So let's talk about what is it, unpack it, what does it do, and then let's talk about this concept of GLP-1 deficiency.
Sure. So thank you for having me.
Of course.
I'm a huge fan of your work too, Callie. I think we're also...
Wait, I just want to say, we don't have to agree on everything, but we actually like each other and we're all friends. So this is good. This is good. This is like what America is missing is nuanced conversations that take different perspectives and actually, you know, come up with a place where we can all learn from each other and actually be open to each other's ideas and have a conversation that isn't just black and white.
Well, the first thing I thought when I got invited onto this podcast was, well, I totally agree with those guys. So what am I going to do here? But I do have some nuanced information I want to share. So my background is I have been in medicine, either working in the field or in practice for nearly 30 years. I've been in naturopathic medicine for 16 years. I was honored to have an incredible mentor for decades who was an amazing naturopathic physician in a very busy practice. And he taught me early on, way back in the 90s, all about metabolic health, all about insulin resistance, all about type 2 diabetes. That was back when Syndrome X was coming on the scene, which is pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome. We didn't even have metabolic syndrome as a diagnosis at the time. And so that's right when I dropped into his world. He taught me about keeping your waist circumference low. He taught me about fatty liver. He taught me about strength training over cardio. He taught me all the things. My whole platform is about metabolic health and doing all the things. And all the things being, you know, mitigate your stress, get your sleep in, protect it, strength train, build muscle, high protein, low carb, get good healthy fats, get sunlight, circadian rhythm, all the things.
Don't forget the vegetables.
Yes, of course. I know you like your vegetables and I try, but this whole thing blew up this last summer with this Ozempic. And I thought, well, these have been around for 20 years, these GLP-1 agonists. So why all of a sudden?
But Ozempic was just approved in 2017.
Yes, right? Yes. But why all of a sudden with the backlash? And it really raised some flags for me. So I started researching, and my background is in regenerative medicine. So regenerative musculoskeletal medicine. I help people rebuild their joints naturally with natural substances, stem cells, PRP. Been doing that for a long, long time. And so the first thing I did was research GLP-1 and its regenerative properties. I always look up things according to what my brain knows. My brain understands pain. I understand regeneration and neuroinflammation. All of those things always interest me greatly. And I found so many studies showing impacts on some of the older versions of GLP-1s and the current versions, impacting neuroinflammation very positively. I found data supporting its potential use in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. I found data showing regenerative properties in joints, in cartilage, in ligaments. And I mean, the list goes on and on. I found data showing used early, it could, because it actually heals the pancreas, it can reverse type 1 diabetes if used early and started early, semaglutide specifically. And I thought, this is not at all what I'm hearing. Like, this is not lining up at all with what I'm hearing. So, of course, I got super interested. I did a podcast. The feedback was incredible. I had people from all over the world messaging me, telling me, I do all the things you say. I do all the things you preach. I mean, I was severely, severely censored during COVID for telling people to go outside in the sun, lift weights, and eat meat. I mean,
God, how radical you are.
I was deplatformed for the work I was pushing back then. So
clearly that's misinformation, right? Eating healthy and exercising and being in the sunlight, God forbid.
The hashtag sunlight was banned in 2020 off of Instagram. So I have been on this journey of sort of bucking the norm for a long time. And I thought, okay, what I'm finding is not lining up with what I'm hearing from everybody. And then of course, all the health influencers had to come out against it. And everybody was really quite hot on my tails about it. I was getting a lot of hate for even mentioning that there might be other impacts that they have on the body. It's regenerative. It's healing and it's anti-inflammatory throughout the body. There's GLP-1 receptors throughout the entire body, including the brain. It's not just made in the gut. It's a steroid, or I'm sorry, it's not a steroid. It's a peptide signaling hormone.
Yeah. Just for people background, peptides are things that our bodies make, and they're the communication networks. And there's tens of thousands of these molecules, and insulin is one of them.
Yep.
And people are using peptides like thymus and alpha-1 or BP-157 for sports injuries. These are things that are available. It's something in a prescription like Ozempic. There are other ones like Vyleesi, which is a prescription for sexual arousal in women and men. So there's a lot of things out there that are used in traditional medicine. Over 70 of these peptides have been approved, and they're things that the body uses naturally. Yep. So they're not things that are pharmacological agents. They're actually things that the body has and uses as part of its normal physiology. So GLP-1 is that. And so when we say GLP-1 agonists, which is what these class of drugs are, it means they work to stimulate the GLP-1 receptors that have the effects of GLP-1.
Correct. However, semaglutide and tirzepatide are actually very closely, well, tirzepatide's a little bit different.
That's Mounjaro for people listening.
Yeah. Semaglutide is almost bioidentical to GLP-1. It's simply got as little tinkering on one of the amino acids to keep the half-life longer. Mm-hmm. So GLP-1 that is produced naturally in the body. It's produced by the L cells of our gut. It's also produced in the brain, in the medulla. If it's produced in the brain, I immediately thought, well, it must have use in the brain. And it sure does. It actually has impact on neuroinflammation beyond appetite signaling, beyond any of that. We've got it sort of in this box of being, it slows gastric motility, it, you know, decreases appetite by slowing gastric motility, very sort of basic kindergarten version. And then in the brain, it inhibits appetite.
Right.
And that's how people have got it. Well, I start looking into it and I'm like, this is a signaling peptide hormone. Why would we macrodose a hormone? You'd feel awful if you were cranking high levels of thyroid or testosterone or estrogen. Right. And those are sex steroid hormones, but still hormones.
Or high doses of insulin, which was one of the first peptides ever synthesized and has been around for a long time.
Right. You'd die if you took high doses, too high of a dose. So I got to thinking, well, why don't we just dose I do bioidentical hormone replacement by dosing physiologic doses, which are much, much lower even than some of the standard dosing. So I've always been a fan of starting people very slow and low on any hormone, and I ramp them up and I titrate them up until they get tissue saturation and until their symptoms resolve. And then that's the dose. And then I test to make sure I'm not causing them any harm. And that's how I manage patients on hormones. We've got leptin and ghrelin. Those are peptide signaling hormones. Turns out leptin and ghrelin, so leptin for the audience listening, is secreted by your fat. It goes to your brain. It tells your brain you're full. It tells your brain, it's basically the thermostat of the brain. It lets the body know energy status, right? Ghrelin is secreted by the stomach and it goes to the brain and tells you you're hungry. I always think ghrelin, right? That's how I remember the two. Yeah. Ghrelin and leptin don't work if GLP-1 isn't present. Hmm. The receptors actually don't even come to the cellular surface. So I was like, well, this is very interesting.
So ghrelin doesn't work because ghrelin seems to be make you hungry. So some people are hungry even when they're overweight and maybe GLP-1 deficient.
The receptor signaling of, and this was just in rats, but the receptor signaling of the whole orchestra of how these work together, it's much more nuanced, I think, than we understand. The orchestra doesn't work if GLP-1 isn't there. So then I thought, I wonder if we have GLP-1 deficiency. I wonder if that's a thing, right? Yeah. It is. Mechanistically, it's a thing in those with fatty liver, those who are obese, and those with type 2 diabetes. And then I thought, is this a chicken or egg?
Right.
Is it due to the chronic insulin resistance and the damage to the vagal nerve and, you know, on and on, and the leaky gut and the damage to the gut mucosa and the damage to the microbiome? Is what is inducing the GLP-1 deficiency?
Even environmental toxins, who knows, right?
Then I started talking to my friends who were like the nerdy genetic people. They love their genetic mutations. And they started telling me that there's SNPs that code for GLP-1 that they're seeing deficiency in those, or they're seeing mutations in those SNPs in a lot of people. And in fact, one of my friends runs a diabetes clinic, has done so for decades, functional medicine, diabetes. And he said that 95% of the patients he's seeing have this genetic SNP mutation. So,
and does that mean like 75% of the people who are overweight in America have this mutation, or is it
I don't know. So what's happening
is unlikely. That's true. It seems like maybe
they all
it seems like probably like a larger portion of maybe the severely obese might have that, right? What were you going to say, Kelly?
Well, we talk a lot. The genetic argument's brought up a lot, and obviously, it's did genetics change in the last 50 years? As obesity has absolutely taken over our country.
But gene expression changes, right? So I think that's the thing that happens.
Yeah, gene expression changes.
I mean, I think it's genes are complicated. There was Darwin, which is, you know, genes change by natural selection over millennia. And then was Lamarck, who said traits can be passed from generation to generation. And Lamarck was kind of dismissed, and Darwin won the day. But the truth is they're both right, because Darwin is about gene changes, and Lamarck is really talking about epigenetic changes, which can happen from generation to generation. And I think one of the things we're seeing now is generations of kids who are born to obese parents. And the consequences of that, the epigenetic changes in the womb that happen from the environment that the baby is bathed in, from processed food and sugar and starch and lack of exercise and stress and all the things, environmental toxins, all of that is programming these children. We know this data from many, many epigenetic studies. It's programming these children to be obese, have heart disease, have diabetes, end up with cancer and many other problems. And they're kind of screwed before they're even born.
Yep.
So these kids come into the world and then they're more likely to be obese or more likely to have these programmed epigenetic changes that maybe are affecting the expression of the genes. So the genes don't change, but the expression changes. And that's, I think, that's an important point. And I agree, Kelly.
But they could change if that child is provided a whole food
diet. That's
right.
Epigenetic changes can be reversed.
Is exposed to sunlight. So we have an Orwellian situation where we have such a crisis in America that children are in utero developing metabolic dysfunction because our food is so toxic and we've had a sedentary lifestyle and aren't looking at the sunlight and being, you know, sleeping, dysregulated sleeping, chronic stress with our phones. So we have such a bad metabolic health environment that we have an epidemic of kids being born, you know, born with metabolic dysfunction. Yeah. So it is societally vital. There's nothing more important than this.
Oh, I agree.
So we have an opportunity. It's not a both and. Are we going to, as a matter of public policy and as a matter of focus in that country, change that dynamic of changing our USDA guidelines to say that 2-year-old shouldn't be eating sugar?
When you go
the route of Ozempic, when you go the route that this is so bad that we need to jab those children at 6, that's a different route. That's a different prioritization.
I'm not sure.
It's not both.
I'm up for giving kids 6 years old those Ozempic.
No.
That's another conversation. I think that's a little extreme. And
But if we agree with the idea, if we actually agree with the science and that this drug is good and should be used as a standard of care, why not?
I don't think any drug is good or bad. You're thinking from public policy, social. I'm a doctor. Tina's a doctor. We're both thinking about the patient we see in our office who's stuck as you know what. And how do we help them? And I've had patients who have lost 200 pounds, 150 pounds, 110 pounds, 116 pounds, 138 pounds, just using food as medicine. But it's tough for them. They can do it. But the question is there something else that could be done in a way that actually is like Tina was saying, is physiologic, that doesn't use this kind of heavy-handed pharmacologic approach to actually help people with fixing some of the metabolic and biochemical things that are going on. And I think this is an open question. I think we need more data on this, but I think what you're saying, Tina, is really interesting, that there are effects of this natural peptide that are different than just regulating weight.
Absolutely.
And they may be working through other mechanisms. You know, I had a patient once say to me recently, can I just take phentermine? And that's basically an appetite suppressant.
Crack.
It's basically speed or crack. Yeah. And basically, it's like crackheads are so skinny because they want to eat because their appetite suppressed. But it's basically speed. And I said, no. This is really not good because it's going to cause you to be anxious, palpitations, and have all these, you know, issues of sleep. And I think it's not a good idea. But, you know, then we talked about Ozempic maybe being a solution because it can be done in a way that is different, that works physiologically and works on some of these other pathways that I think people aren't aware of. Like the neuroinflammation is a big one. And I think what we're seeing is sometimes decreased suicide rates. We're seeing decreased depression. We're seeing a lot of other things with these drugs. And I think, well, how is that happening? And what's probably happening, in my view, is people are eating less of the crap because they don't want it. And so their brain and their body inflammation is going down. And maybe some of the effects of the GLP-1 drugs are anti-inflammatory by mechanism.
They are.
And so if that's true, then, you know, the neuroinflammation crisis, and I've talked a lot about this on the podcast and written a whole book about it called The Ultra Mind Solution, is our brains are on fire, and our brains on fire lead to depression, anxiety, suicide, aggression, you know, societal division, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. I mean, the list goes on and on. Anything that affects the brain is about inflammation. So these drugs may modulate that. It's fascinating. So they're being studied for Alzheimer's and many other things. Now, I think the idea that we should just like fall in love with this drug and it's great for everybody and we should put it in the water, I don't think Tina or anybody, I think, who is smart about this thinks that. But for the select patient, in a way, given in a way that can actually regulate some of these pathways, I'm not so sure it should be thrown out. It's like any tool. It's like any tool we have in medicine. It's for the right person at the right time,
Who is the right person, just generically? I'm just curious.
Well, that's a great question. So
finish what I was trying to tell you guys. I started using this in patients, and I have only one who is using it for weight loss. Everybody else is on it for a different reason. So, and I'm using it at a fifth of the starting dose, compounded, droplets. And when I started doing this, my colleagues all started, who listened to my podcast, all started also microdosing GLP-1s in their clinics. And we've all reported back to each other, and we're seeing phenomenal results in all different kinds of conditions. That leads me to believe that we may actually be able to do away with a lot of the lifestyle pharmaceuticals that people are using. So people are on other drugs for life, such as high blood pressure meds or statin drugs. These peptides have been shown to heal heart tissue and to reverse heart failure. So I've got one patient on it for high blood pressure, tiny little dose, high blood pressure is down. I personally take it because I have psoriatic arthritis and I have crippling pain from tip to toe. It doesn't matter how clean of a life I live. It doesn't matter how clean my fish tank is. Menopause hit me. The brain fog was real and the pain came with it. And I knew it was due to neuroinflammation. So tiny little doses mitigates my autoimmune conditions, like nothing I've ever used, without any side effects. None of the people I'm using it on, none of the patients that my colleagues are using it on are having any side effects. You keep the dose low. The nausea, the vomiting, the terrible side effects, the muscle loss, that is all a dosing and management issue. And brand names start in a pre-filled pen. I don't use them. They're too high of a dose. We are mono dosing at high doses, monotherapy, a hormone. And that's why we're seeing these horrific side effects, which I completely agree with. I've listened to your argument on different podcasts, and I'm like, I totally agree with them. I totally agree with what's happening there. But we wouldn't throw out thyroid if all the doctors were overdosing their patients on thyroid. It's a management and dosing issue on the doctor's part. And then how compliant are patients,
right? Why is pharma starting the dose so high? I mean, the injection first dose is 0.5 milligrams, and it goes to 1 and 2. You're talking about using 0.1 or 0.08 to start, which is a fifth of that.
Tiny, because they're dealing with severely metabolically busted people already. And the people I'm dealing with are doing all the things and are generally metabolically healthy.
But what if you had someone
American is metabolic.
What would you do if you had someone come in who was like 350 pounds? Who would you start them on?
Or the average American.
So you give them a leg up. I have a license to prescribe. So I prescribe things to give people a leg up. I do use Prozac as needed at very low doses. And the way that I have been taught by my mentor is when a patient comes in and here's their pharmacological profile and here's their lifestyle, you lower this as much as humanly possible or get them off is the goal. The reason I became a naturopathic physician in the state of Oregon so I can prescribe is to get people off drugs. And then you bring up their lifestyle.
You have to have a license to put them on and to take them off.
Right? You bring up their lifestyle, right? And so you hopefully get this as low as possible. Mm-hmm. But I'm not opposed to keeping people on tiny little doses. This is not the first drug I microdosed. I microdosed Prozac in patients. I've microdosed statins. I microdosed all kinds of drugs to give them. You get a different mechanism of action when you use things at tiny little dosages than when you macrodose them. Macrodosing a drug gives you a different pharmacologic impact on the body.
And do they work at that low dose for people?
Yeah.
To get the weight off? What if they're, for your patients who are not really doing it for weight issues, I understand.
Everybody lost weight.
But what about for people who are like 300 pounds? Did you start with the same dose?
So I have one patient who is morbidly obese. He's well over 300 something pounds and can't move, in so much pain, he can't move. He sleeps in a lazy boy, spends all day in a lazy boy, doesn't get up, doesn't move, cognition's off, has had two mini strokes. I don't even have him at the starting dose yet. And it's been months and he is very happily, very slowly shedding the weight.
Yeah, the starting dose, the pharmacologic starting dose.
Yes, so I've got him at a fraction of that and his cognition has improved. The cognitive impacts have been huge. I've seen it eradicate depression. I've seen it reverse PCOS. I've seen people walk straight into fertility after decades of infertility issues from PCOS, or just decades of PCOS. So, and this is all at micro doses. I'm talking droplets.
So this compound, which our body makes, maybe is deficient because of why. Why is it because of epigenetic programming? Is it because of our microbiome changing? Is it because of toxins in the environment?
I think all of it. You know, the mess of toxic soup we live in. Yeah. I mean, we live in a toxic soup, period. Epigenetically, like you said, mothers, the data around maternal diabetes and metabolic inflammation in the offspring. Do you know Pottinger's cats? Did you guys ever hear about Pottinger's cats? Yeah. So Pottinger in the 30s took cats and he fed them. He was a veterinarian. He fed them cooked meat and pasteurized milk.
Yeah.
That's all he did was change it. And within 1 to 3 generations, they were completely infertile. Their intestines were inflamed and boggy. Their livers were enlarged and fatty, infiltrate. And it took him multiple generations with optimal cat diet, which is raw milk and raw meat, multiple generations to reverse them back to a fertile, healthy animal.
Yeah.
So I'm 50. I watched all of this happen. I've seen it. I remember when there was like one kid in school who truly had a glandular problem, who was overweight.
Yeah.
I've watched this.
Erica, my class.
I've watched this whole thing unfold. I've watched food change. I've been battling against it too for a long, long time, but we're in a pickle.
Yeah.
And I am actually a few generations into potting, or at least one into the Pottinger's cats. My parents, the boomers, had the convenience foods. Mm-hmm. Crisco oil came into play, and here we are. And my daughter,
margarine, that was what I lived on when I was a kid.
Yeah, me too. And Wonder Bread and bologna. But my daughter's 24 next week, and her generation is a mess. Yeah. It's a mess
because of the pharmaceutical industrial complex and treating everything in silos.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
But this is treating obesity in a silo.
I'm not talking about treating obesity.
Kelly, do you see a world in where it's not either or? There may be a role for using these drugs in patients to help, along with an intensive lifestyle intervention and a functional medicine approach, to correct some of the problems that may have been driving the GLP-1 deficiency and not have them on it forever.
Let me give my high-level perspective on that and then go into like certain patient archetypes and cases. I'm really skeptical, and I think viewers and listeners just need to make up their own mind. I'm very skeptical at the billing of this drug as a miracle drug for all chronic conditions. There has never, by my account in American history, been a chronic disease pharmaceutical product that's lowered rates of the chronic disease it's ostensibly trying to treat. More statins, more heart disease, more metformin, more diabetes, more SSRIs, more depression. You can go down the list.
But it's not a drug.
Well, because people don't change their lifestyle.
Exactly. It's a moral hazard. I talk about my mom a lot, right? My mom was on 5 different medications, right? When she was diagnosed with cancer, she would have certainly been on Ozempic. She had trouble losing the baby weight and was never obese, but obese after she had me. And, you know, she was on the statin, on the metformin. And there's a choice a doctor has, right? They can follow your work. And when the person has an elevated waistline or has elevated cholesterol or has elevated blood sugar, they can open your book and talk about how they have to go on a path of curiosity and a path of metabolic health to get their biomarkers and get their underlying metabolic health more under control. And that cannot be injected and it cannot be pilled. And frankly, I would argue that it's very clear from the data and experience that putting the savior in a lifetime chronic disease treatment has been a total failure, because inevitably what happens.
I agree. In a perfect world, we'd have a healthy environment in the country where we had all the defaults being healthy, where there wasn't processed food, where people were moving naturally, where we had lower stress, where we weren't being sleep deprived, where we weren't exposed to a load of environmental toxins. I want that world,
right?
100%. We don't live in that world. And I see patients, for example, who have had complications from conditions. So for example, we're doing clearly heart scans, looking at AI-interpreted coronary angiograms, and we're seeing people with lots of plaque and dangerous plaque and risk plaque. And those people, I will put on medication. It's not the solution to someone who's younger, who doesn't have a solution to problem to prevent it. But there may be a time for medications in people's lives that actually can be used in a way that helps reverse the problem.
And as I said at the beginning, I'm not concerned with that patient. I'm not concerned with that edge case. I'm concerned with the average person listening. I'm concerned with the average American who's overweight or obese. I'm concerned with the average American teen right now who's overweight or obese. I'm concerned with that person. I'm not concerned with the person on the edge cases. Is this the treatment for obesity? And all you need to do is look at JP Morgan, their stock analysis for the Novo Nordisk stock. They project an increase in obesity over the coming 10 years. They project as this drug is prescribed widely and approved and government funded, they assume that obesity is going to go up. You just have to ask why that is.
Why is that?
One more quick thing, I think this really helps.
Why would they say
Because
that?
There's never been a chronic disease drug, and this is a drug, in history that has lower rates of the chronic disease it's trying to treat. It is a moral hazard. Obesity is not an Ozempic deficiency. Alzheimer's, heart disease isn't an Ozempic deficiency. The message of this drug, whether you do it a low dose or high dose, quite frankly, because if you start at a low dose, you have to take it for life in order to maintain it.
No, you don't.
You absolutely have to take it for life unless you dramatically change your lifestyle habits, right. In which case the drug isn't necessary.
I think we're on the same page here because I don't think anybody believes that you can use a drug without lifestyle change. And sometimes people need a bridge. For example, some people need a leg up who are just so stuck. And I am humbled as a doctor because, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, a philosophy based on a very pure idea of what we should be doing. But the reality is there are real people with real issues who struggle, and even with their best efforts, they can't succeed. And so that's a problem I see. And it may be because of the things that are not within their control. In other words, there may be things that are going on biologically with the drastic change in our microbiome and environmental toxins, which I think are the two biggest things going on, that make it hard for people to actually correct those things without some help.
Mark, respect you, your books and your teachings have changed my life and where I'm on this path. And I just have to say, we need to be clear to the American people listening to this. If they're facing metabolic dysfunction, try not eating ultra-processed food. Try cutting that from your diet.
Have you had a patient in front of you who's dealing with chronic mold or SIRS or severe trauma and adverse childhood events, and it doesn't work?
So I want to go through two patient archetypes, okay? If you are the median American who is on, you know, a couple chronic disease medications and overweight or slightly obese, right? Let's go through this. If you go on Ozempic at whatever dose, right, it's only going to work, and you can only go off of it if you radically change your lifestyle habits. So we're all in agreement with that. You can only go off of it
unless
you radically change.
Right.
I just want to make sure we're all aligned.
100%.
So there's no point in really taking it unless you're going to radically change your habits for life, not a crash course, not a jump start, but actually really have almost a spiritual reset in your life to change your habits.
Agreed.
Okay. If you go off of it, if you do it and go off of it and don't change your habits, you're going to gain the weight back.
Correct.
So if we need a massive, and I'm talking for the median person listening, if we need a massive, almost revolutionist country where we have to change our metabolic habits, whether we're taking the drug or not, why not start with that? Why do we need this drug?
If we have a society where all that's possible, great. We just don't.
What is the evidence that the drug helps if we're not changing our habits?
It gives you the ability. Well, first of all,
the ability to change your habits.
Lose 5 to 10% of your body weight and see what happens. You start moving more. You feel better. You have less pain. Yeah. You're more inclined. Most people that I'm seeing on it don't actually want to start changing things significantly until about the 2 month mark. And all of a sudden they start talking about, hey doc, what should I do for exercise? What should I be doing beyond walking? The hedonic urge to eat the junk is gone.
It comes back when you go off of it, doesn't it?
Not always. It actually is having a regenerative impact. There is a long-term regenerative impact and a healing impact from the peptides. And we have the data on it. I'm not sure what data you're looking at, but the data I'm looking at is not showing exactly the same thing.
And I would say, Callie, as PEP, just to understand pharmacology versus physiology. So someone has a thyroid dysfunction. They have low thyroid hormone. We give them thyroid hormone for life. Now, some people can get off it if you change a lot of things. But
some people can't.
Some people can't. You know, if you take a pharmacologic substance, it's working in ways that are inhibiting, blocking, or somehow interfering with normal physiology. Peptides are things that our body uses to regulate its function. I personally use peptides for my own health. I use peptides in my patients for all sorts of different things, from tissue repair to hormonal support to immune support to anxiety and brain health. Mm-hmm. And they're quite effective. And I don't shy away from using those in the right patient in the right way. So as a class of compounds, they're different than pharmacologic compounds, even though they've been co-opted by the pharmaceutical industry. Now, the FDA is trying to shut down the use of peptides because they're so effective.
Right.
Yes.
And they're physiologic. So I always think of something when I treat somebody, is this nature-made or man-made, right? If it's nature-made, I tend to think that it's working with the body rather than against the body. And the question is, you know, if you give something like vitamin D, which is nature made at massive doses, it's going to cause a lot of harm. But if you give vitamin D to those who are deficient in it in a physiologic dose, it may actually help them function better. So I'm always kind of thinking about medicine in that perspective. I worked, for example, with a woman who has struggled for a long time, for decades, with weight. And she tried. She knew what to do. You know, she'd been a victim of terrible trauma when she was younger. She, you know, saw her mother literally stabbed to death in front of her by her stepfather. She was kidnapped and thrown in a car. She was